You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another podcast. So a few months ago, we did our webinar on investing between Pueblo versus Colorado Springs versus Denver. And from that webinar, I've had a lot of great conversations with people up and down the Front Range. And our guest today is one of those people I had a conversation with. His name is David Resnick, and David focuses on developing residential communities with an emphasis on community. As he puts it, it's one thing to subdivide land into lots and a totally different thing to create a livable, high-quality community. And specifically, the reason we connected is because he's actively working on a community down in Pueblo. So I asked David to come in here, sit down with us to talk about how he got into developing and also his Pueblo project. So David, welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this, and everyone out there can't see it, but I'm holding David's resume, which has got it's very impressive. And as I was telling you, David, before we hit the record button, I'm not quite sure where to start in asking you how you got into developing. So might as well just kind of jump back from day one into how you got into real estate and then tell us how you got into developing.
Okay, well, it was serendipitous for sure. I started as a person that didn't know what my career was going to be. I was going to college, and I decided that I wanted to make some money. So my mother said, why don't you get into the real estate business? So I went down to Anthony Schools in San Diego and got a real estate license when I was 19. Then I tromped on down to Pacific Beach, and I ended up becoming a real estate agent. And lo and behold, someone who actually was kind of like a lot of your clients that bought and sold a lot of properties down along the beach took a liking to me and decided he was going to make me his exclusive kind of real estate guy.
Sounds like a good thing.
That was a really good thing. I mean, I was basically trying to find him houses down in Pacific Beach where he could build a duplex behind them. And that same person and I ended up working together for a very long time. But because he was really looking for property that had land behind it, I just got interested in finding and selling apartment land. And I started to sell apartment land to people in that San Diego region that were becoming pretty large apartment developers. And so I just fell into the land business. And San Diego in the late 70s was a pretty good place to fall into the land business.
Because there was still land back then to build apartments on?
Well, no, I mean, just because it was growing. It was at such a great place in its growth curve. And one of the areas that had not opened up in San Diego was just north of the Naval Air Base, which is Miramar Naval Air Station. And it became Mira Mesa and those communities north of that air station. But at that time, nobody was really doing much out there. So I was sort of a pioneer in an area that grew very quickly. So I got lucky. Well, one of the guys that was buying stuff for me decided he wanted to go over to Arizona. So I went over to Arizona and looked for property for him. And as most young men do, I fell in love with someone and kind of stayed there. And a guy named Frank Aries hired me. Frank Aries was the person who bought the Howard Hughes estate in Arizona and Nevada. It was 11,000 acres. And while I worked for Frank, he also began his purchase of the Banning Lewis Ranch in Colorado Springs. So I carried his briefcase for him and came up and saw that. And that's how I really broke into the larger land development stuff, is that I just kind of walked into the right places at the right time and learned from a guy that was a real master.
Now, I actually want to dive into this because I enjoy hearing how people become successful, whether it's in real estate or business or wherever. But you talked about how you became lucky as an agent and whatever investor down there in San Diego took a liking to you. You became lucky with finding apartment stuff. I have a feeling it wasn't just pure luck. Like, you had to be doing something right to create the luck. I mean, was it just pure hustle? Was it your attitude or like?
Well, I mean, thank you. I think if I were going to add anything, really, truly, it was luck. But there were two other elements. Number one, I was a hard worker and I still am a hard worker. I enjoyed what I was doing and I enjoyed working. And then the second thing is I liked what I was doing enough to really study it. You know, I mean, back in those days, the kind of books we read were the Lookout for Number One by Robert Ringer. Okay. So that guy became my hero and I went out and I understood apartments really well. I understood exactly what the expenses were, how they worked, what the construction costs were and everything else. And so if a guy came to me looking for apartment land, he wasn't talking to someone that just said, oh, I know this property, this and this and this. I actually understood the numbers well enough to make sure it worked.
Okay.
The second thing I did, I got to say, is that I recognized also this was really the part that catapulted me into success. In the late 70s, there were a lot of new regulations that came online in California. And a lot of the states followed suit, but they were having to do with the Subdivision Map Act and getting property subdivided and so forth. So the builders hated that. The builders like inventory. They want lots to build homes on. And they don't really like it when, you know, regulations come along that take another 6 months or 1 year of effort in order to get that inventory, those lots. And what I started doing is saying, look, I'll take your process through the tentative map and final map stages. In California, they don't call it a plat, they call it maps. And all you got to do is give me my brokerage fee. I was still a broker at that time. And so I think it was that I was willing to work hard and to know what I was doing.
And so really in that scenario where you're taking it through the process, you made your money on the back end after 1 or 2 or 3 years selling the property? Is that?
No, I just got a lot of business as a broker.
Okay, getting the land.
Because a home builder would go to me and buy land knowing I'm going to do a lot of this work getting it through that subdivision process. And I only really did that for about a year. Then I got smart and said, wait a second. Here's a guy with land that he wants 2,000 an acre for. And I know once I've got it mapped, I can sell it for 8,000 an acre. I just have to option it for 1 year. And so I became a land flipper option guy. So that's really where my success started to take off.
All right, dive into that. So, and I know very little bit about land flipping and land development. So talk to me like I'm an eighth grader. How's that process work? You get the land, you put an option on there. Just what's the flow chart?
Well, it's a lot like your business. So, you know, I shared with you earlier, I really don't know about your business either. I mean, it's as foreign to me as going to NASA almost. But what I do understand is that in the land business, there is a very large difference both in price, time, work, effort, and everything else between land that has no entitlements and land that is ready to build on. And those stages, you know, back when I started in the early 80s, there were only really two stages. It took about 6 months, you know. Now there's many stages, many more than 10 or 15 even stages on larger projects, and they can take anywhere from a couple years to 10 or 15 years or more. But the essence is that you still have to find a place where someone wants to live. And the further out you get from where they want to live right now, the lower the price is of that land. So you want to find a sweet spot where you get it just far enough out that you're matching the time it will take to get the entitlements with the time it will take for the market to get to you. And if you do that, then you get what turns out to be a pretty good price on the land, and you have the time to get the entitlement work done. Talking to you, if I was going to say start to finish, is the zoning layer is the first layer, the land use layer. So you're going to be in some jurisdiction, whether it's a city or a county, and they're going to have decided what use that land will have, or they haven't. If they have, well, you have to either live with that or find a way to convince them there's a better use. And I've done that. That can be profitable. Or the second thing is, if they don't have a plan for the use, you got to create one for them that they buy into. But without that entitlement, that layer of land use and zoning, you really can't even start moving with a property at all.
Okay. And then I know zoning, getting councils or cities to change zoning can be an uphill battle. Do you, I mean, what type of due diligence do you do before you buy a chunk of land and it's not zoned the way you want it to be? Like, can you, do you put out feelers before to estimate the changing in zoning, or how do you mitigate that risk of, hey, I want to buy this and then zone agriculture or whatever it is, and you want to turn it into, you know, a subdivision? How do you even start that process?
That's a great question. For me, it depends on where you are. There are cities where the city council or the governing body is real strong, and that's fairly rare. Mostly, they react to what the people in the area want. And so I prefer to buy property that's already zoned, but otherwise, I go to the community. And the best way to go to a community for a parcel of land. Now, the other thing is, if you're buying 5 acres for 20 lots, it's a completely different thing than buying 500 acres for 1,000 lots. And they both take about the same work, believe it or not. So I always try to get the largest property I can. But the best way to get in touch with the community is go to the homeowner association for the closest subdivision next to wherever you're going to develop and just talk to them, you know, and maybe even go to a meeting and share with them your idea, and not take it personally, because they always don't like what you're doing the first time they see it. People are that way.
NIMBY syndrome, right? Not in my backyard. Is it that?
It's NIMBY syndrome. It's why should anything change? It's there's just no reason to be enthusiastic for someone else. I have never gone somewhere where people said, this is great, we're 100% behind you. They always say no, and always say there's something wrong, or there's more roads, or there's more traffic, or there's barking dogs, or you're going to have light, I can't see the stars, you know, 100 reasons. But it's just a matter of helping them understand not only what the project really is going to be, but giving them the time to get comfortable with a change and with who, you know, the developer is.
And, I mean, you make it sound like it's very simple, and I can't imagine it's that simple, because you're dealing with groups of people and emotions, which, from my experience, is not always the best combination. You just stay persistent, you have conversations, and you educate. Is really just that kind of that simple?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want it to sound like every project I've ever done has worked out, because they haven't. I mean, I've had a lot of projects that did not work out. You know, I mean, one example I'll give you is, there's a project in San Diego that I got involved with, and it was in an area where the land was designated to be industrial land on the fringe of the county of San Diego. And there was a city adjacent to that, the city of San Marcos. This is that project I was talking to you about, San Leo Hills. So the county supervisor had put all of his political clout behind a trash to energy plant. This was going to be the solution for San Diego's trash. They were going to have a plant where it was next to a landfill, and they were going to put in this trash to energy plant that would burn this stuff and supposedly create energy from the heat. And it had a 300-foot high smokestack. The people that surrounded that proposed trash to energy plant hated it. They were, like, thousands of them would show up at every single meeting, but the process of getting this pushed through the political system was happening. And I went to the city of San Marcos. I said, hey, you know, there's 3,000 acres here, and it's really in between the fastest growing city in Northern California, was Carlsbad at the time, and Escondido. And this should be a residential property. And they said, yeah, we agree. Well, a couple of their council members were all behind the trash to energy plant, because there was some revenue sharing that was going on. But to make a long story short, I had 3,000 homeowners, and they wanted anything but a trash to energy plant. And they actually all signed a petition and said, we want this residential housing you know, proposal that Resnick's trying to push through. And so that's the power of the community. It can swing both ways, but it is a very powerful force. And if you can align with it or find a way there's common interests or benefits or incentives, it's you can really get everybody on board with what you're trying to do.
So when did you start doing development work out here in Colorado? I know you started in California, then Arizona, then Colorado. What was the time frame?
So my career started in California, but in that time I did projects in Texas, Arizona, and Idaho. And in 2008, I had lots that were worth X. And all of a sudden, you know, and I could see things were shifting. I mean, I'd been through a couple of recessions in the 90s and in the 80s, and I kind of expected it to go about the same way. I just felt I was going to have to weather a year. But all of a sudden, about 3 months later, literally I had hundreds of contracts with builders that were buying lots just drop, just like, and all my lots went from X to like 0.2x. Literally the drop was that significant. I mean, my property was worth a fifth of what it was 3 months before.
And have you ever seen that significant of a drop
Never.
In previous recessions?
Never.
Okay.
Never. And I mean, I even had a situation where I had lines of credit that went from 6%, you know, where they were basically probably 8% interest, and they went up to 18 and 19% interest. But I could go to the lender and say, give me an extra year to work through this. But in this situation, when the prices dropped and things happened, and, you know, once Lehman went down, the banks were out of business. So they would say, no, we're not going to, I couldn't draw any more money out of any of my construction loans to pay contractors and subs. Then the contractors and subs starts, to, you know, it just was terrible. I've never seen it like that.
And totally off topic here, but I mean, I always like to pick people's brains that's been through the good, the bad, and the really bad. I mean, do you think what we saw in 2008, is that like a once in a generational event? Do you expect to see something that drastic again? I know it's a really hard question, and I know you don't have your crystal ball sitting next to you, but you've been through the good times and the bad times.
Yeah, well, so in 2008... I lost about 80% of the money I'd accumulated over the past 40 years.
Wow.
And, you know, it was at that very moment, probably more like 100%, but, you know, by patience and working things out, you know, I probably retained maybe at the very most 15 or 20% of what I'd had. And so it was a significant shift in my life. And I became hugely depressed. I mean, and I left San Diego and moved to Boulder. And I thought I was never going to be in the real estate business again. So that was my mindset. So yes, it was significant. I'd never felt that way through any of the other recessions or anything like that, or even losing a deal here or there. So I've thought about it. Now, if you look historically at how any kind of business works economically, there's these cycles with little up and down dips and major ups. And, you know, we had a major dip. And do I think that's the kind of thing that happens generationally? I think it's multi-generational. I think, you know, we had a Great Depression in the in 1930. We had this great recession in 2008. The effect on me for this 2008 Great Recession was just as great as if I would have been a farmer in 1930. So, you know, I don't know why they like to name these things differently. I guess they have some reason for it. I mean, I'm being facetious. I understand the reason, but the point is, yeah, it was a really bad deal. And I came here and thought I wasn't going to be a real estate land developer anymore. And the only reason that I got back in the business, to be honest, is that I got a little bit bored, and a really great broker here in Denver, a commercial broker, Stu Mosco over at Cushman Wakefield, brought me this ranch in Pueblo. And it was just up my alley, or whatever the expression is, because it had so many challenges. So that's really how I got back in.
So let's talk, because that's the project you're working on, Pueblo, right now, right?
Yes.
So let's just dive into that, because I looked at the website, I watched the video that you put together, and I'll put the links in the show notes so people can watch it. But it's a massive project, and I didn't know how to begin to describe it. So I'm going to just let you tell that story and talk about the different facets to it.
Well, so it's 4,850 units of residential, and that's every different type: homes, apartments, condos, townhomes. There'll probably be some retirement communities or assisted living facilities or things of that nature. 4,850 residential units makes 12 to 13,000 people. So it's a significant number of housing units for Pueblo. Pueblo County, or the Pueblo MSA, has a population of about 160 plus thousand folks. I'm probably off plus or minus 5,000, but, and so this is a 20-year, maybe 30-year project, but it's a great project. It's located at the northeastern portion of Pueblo, which makes it close to Colorado Springs. So if you look at it just from the standpoint of Pueblo, which went from 1,200 building permits in the county pre-2008 to 200 and even less than 200 building permits for many of the years since then, you would go, okay, well, this is about 500 years worth of product. There's just no reason to even get interested in this. But you have to, I think, look more at the macro development area, which is what I would call the Colorado Corridor. Colorado Corridor is anchored by Fort Collins on the north and Pueblo on the south. And the anchoring isn't just because that's where the major water courses are or where the biggest cities are along the I-25 corridor. The anchoring is also because Fort Collins has CSU. Mm-hmm. And Pueblo has CSU, and those kind of facilities make a big difference. And it just sort of establishes Pueblo as the southern end of this corridor. Now, the fact is, Pueblo is thought of as the ugliest child in the corridor. I mean, you wouldn't want to go there if you could go to Denver or Fort Collins or Colorado Springs, because they're much more romantic and they've gotten a lot better press, and people would try to make you believe that they have less crime and other things. But if you really look at the numbers, that's not true. So it's sort of, hey, I'm buying a piece of the Colorado Corridor for about 10% or 20% of what it would cost anywhere else along this corridor. If this corridor is going to grow, and if it's going to grow in the kind of rates that we're seeing it grow now, and it's supposedly projected to grow out over the next 10 years, then Pueblo is maybe being missed or overlooked a little bit. And that could be partly due to its local politics, or it could just be due to that stigma that we all get, that all cities get, that all people get, that takes a little bit longer to overcome than it really exists. So I thought, this could be a great opportunity. And that's how I started to get into that project.
So I got so many questions to ask you from there. So just going back to your macro point of view, the big picture point of view, which is that's kind of my more focus when I look at investing, whether it's just stocks or real estate, just, hey, what's the big picture? And I'm going to ride the trend. I don't believe I'm that smart, but if I can be an average investor and ride a trend, I consider myself successful in that context. What gives you the optimistic outlook, or what data points to look at to say, hey, in 10, 20, 30 years, Pueblo and the Colorado Corridor, why is it such a great investment?
Well, okay, so there's a couple reasons. The macro reasons are that you've got a country that produces 21% of the world's GDP. Okay, so that's a big deal. I mean, what we don't really always think about is how big a deal that is. China, Brazil, Europe, all these other areas that produce large chunks of the GDP for the world, they're going to grow, and probably the U.S. could shrink. I mean, but it still is 1/5 of the world's GDP. There's just tremendous manufacturing and output that comes out of the United States. Well, there are probably 20 or 30 maybe large corridors or metropolitan areas where these things get produced. You've got Silicon Valley, which everybody knows. You've got the Wall Street Financial District, Chicago, and so forth, Southern California. But one of them is Colorado. And that Colorado output comes from this Colorado corridor along I-25.
Really?
Sure. Huh. I mean, what gets produced by Colorado primarily gets produced within that corridor from Fort Collins to Pueblo. So it's a big deal. It's a big place where there's a lot of output. And, you know, if you were just simply saying, hey, I want to go to where the greatest output is, you might go, you know, 100 other places or a dozen other places. And I mean, it bodes pretty well for what I'm saying, just the fact that Amazon did look at the Denver metropolitan area as one of its top 10 or 20 finalists. So I think just that is one of the main reasons I have such a positive outlook. But the key reason, once you drill down from there, is infrastructure. You've got the freeway system. You've got the Denver International Airport. You've got the Colorado Springs Airport. Pueblo has an airport with a 10,400-foot runway that can land almost any kind of cargo plane you want to put down on it, and certainly passenger jets if it ever got to that. So that's a big deal, and most people don't really know that. It also has tens of thousands of available industrial land. If anybody ever did choose to make a huge play, and when I say a huge play, I mean move 10,000 jobs and, you know, millions of square feet of warehouse or data centers into the Denver marketplace, you would really have trouble finding a better place to put that than the Pueblo area.
Hmm. I mean, I'm not in agreement. Like, your logic and the big picture makes sense. So something else I'm really curious about, because... And I know you said Pueblo's probably right around 160,000 people. And you said your development, when it's all said and done, is going to be 12 to 13,000 people. I mean, roughly that's, what, 5, 6, 7% of the population there.
Yeah.
I think if I'm doing my math correctly.
It's even more than that, 7 or 8%. It's almost 10%, yeah.
I mean, you're moving the needle on there.
Oh,
or
yeah.
You're riding the trend. I'm not sure. So what gives you, because you were saying at the beginning of the podcast how it's about matching up that future need or that future want for growth and matching up the timeline. How are you doing that with the Pueblo development and seeing that growth in population? Do you have like data you're looking at, or just that big picture data is what's driving you and saying, hey, you know what? More people will move here as the economy grows.
Okay, so you're drilling down into the small stuff, and your podcast was a big factor for me. What you guys said, and I know it had a particular meaning for a lot of you, you know, for the people that invest in real estate, but the meaning that it held for me was, and how I was hearing what happened to that podcast, is that there was a 7 cap rate basically in Denver, Colorado Springs, and Pueblo. Well, if Pueblo has the same cap rate going on that those two markets have, that means that the balance of supply and demand has got to be pretty much the same, in line with Denver and Colorado Springs, which are both awesome monster markets, right? So one of my suspicions about Pueblo has always been that the local sharp guys and gals in Pueblo, they're down there and they're staying quiet. And I've seen that many, many times. I've seen that in the different markets I've worked in. I've seen it in the Arizona market, California market, and Texas markets. There are these sort of areas where people are making a lot of money and they don't have any motivation to try and bring more people in.
Yep.
So I thought, hey, maybe my suspicion's right. I didn't think that. I actually thought that sort of confirms what I'd thought. I don't have the skill set and knowledge you guys do to be able to compare properties like you did in that podcast. And I did not know the cap rates were in that 7 range until I heard the podcast. But that is one really compelling piece of information. Another one is that Colorado Springs is just off the charts. I mean, it's one of the top 10 markets in the entire country, and the building permits just keep going up and up and up, and so do the prices. Fountain's kind of taken off, but what's happened in Fountain is it's sort of not even considered Colorado Springs. And since it's not considered Colorado Springs, it's sort of its own little area that people don't, you know, they're either going to love it or hate it. Most of them don't love it. So Pueblo really comes into play, especially along its northern edges, as a bedroom community of Colorado Springs and eventually of Denver. There is no question, my background being in Southern California, where people typically drive over an hour to get to work and an hour to get home, helps, because I've seen 2-lane, you know, freeways like I-25 go to 5-lane highways. And I've seen people commute from places like Denver to Pueblo and all that and everything in between. And I'm not suggesting that's going to happen. Truly, what I do think is going to happen is in the next 10 years, there's going to be a high-speed rail service, and you'll get to Denver in 10 minutes from Pueblo.
I would love it if they put in one of those high-speed rails or maglev or hyperloops or whatever, because I read some of those articles. That would just be so cool. So drilling, going back to your development out there, you've got, you said, what, 4,850 units of residential stuff. Just... where are you at in the process right now, and just kind of what's the next few years look like of that development?
I have to prove that it works. So I'm along I-25. That's another important thing to me, because if we do have high-speed rail, if we do get self-driving cars, if all these technological advances start to happen, being along I-25 is where the first wave of growth will occur. And I do, I mean, listen, the iPhone came out when? 2007. You tell people that and they go, no, it was more than 10 or 12 years ago. That's not, but that's really the truth. So things could change very fast. And all of a sudden, my 20 to 30 year long project could happen in 10 years very easily if there was a high-speed rail service or anything where people could really easily get from Denver to Pueblo and buy a $300,000 house that's half the price of the similar house in Denver. So, but I got to prove it. I got to prove it's a good community. I got to prove that as a developer, I've done it right. So what I have done is I've formed a metropolitan district, which creates the ability to tax. And that ability is critical, because that's how you get the money to do the larger pieces of infrastructure, like the connection to I-25, which includes a bridge over Fountain Creek. And I've created a good quality homeowners association, and we've got a first development area of 750 homes. I've got my first home builders in there, and I made that first development area a net zero ready community. So every house that gets built is going to get built with the kind of quality you have to build in order to be net zero ready.
What does net zero mean?
Net zero ready. And I'm saying net zero ready. So net zero means that you do not use any outside, you know, you generate as much electricity as you're using, or power, or energy. And net zero ready means that you're capable of that. So I know that what it really means is you're building a house with a pretty tight envelope, so air is not leaking out. It doesn't cost more to heat. You're putting in the kind of appliances that are energy efficient. All the green stuff is happening. And you're creating an electrical system and a roof and everything else where a person could put solar panels on that property. Or if there was going to be a community solar farm, they could connect that solar produced energy to their electrical panel.
So I love the concept of that, and I just had this random idea pop in my mind. I've always been curious about it. like the use of gray water, you know, in people's washing machines and the toilet water, not the stuff in the bowl, but the tank, like all that water just goes down the sewer drain. And I've read reports and on websites just talking about, you know, how much water that is and how it can be used to then water the lawn, or there's a lot of like secondary purposes it can be used for. Is that included in the net zero, or is that more energy efficient, not including water waste and water efficiency?
Yeah, the net zero has to do with energy, not with water. But all those kind of things are part of how you build a community. And, you know, the more, so for example, you know, if you just even think about your own housing needs, you're going to go where you feel like it's like-minded people that live, or it's the kind of quality construction you want, or the type of neighborhood or whatever. So in this neighborhood, we've got to create some kind of character, a personality. And a part of creating that personality that we've chosen is to make it net zero ready. That there are people where that would be appealing and mm-hmm. others where it isn't. And we've also decided to create a homeowners association with a particular kind of characterization and personality. And that is going to show up either because people buy homes or people say, I'm not going to buy a house. And over the next couple of years, we need to prove that we're a community where people want to buy homes. And if we can prove that we're a community where people want to buy homes from Colorado Springs and drive back and forth, then that's a whole nother level.
So you're... the proving aspect is going to be this first phase of 750 houses, and that's your going to prove the rest of the development.
That's what we did. Home builders are right now. Let's just say you got 100 potential home builders. 99 of them say we're not going to go to Pueblo, but their reason for not going to Pueblo is because they have some number of homes they need to build. They either need to build 30 homes per year in any subdivision they take on, or 100 homes per year in whatever subdivision they take.
Okay.
That's how the home builder thinks. So, because that's their business. So if they look at Pueblo, where, well, Pueblo's now coming up into the 450, 500 units per year range, still, if you got to do 50 homes a year in your one subdivision, that's a lot of homes out of a 400 or 500 total permit per year. They're getting more willing, but they're still reluctant. They can't really see. And, you know, there's some guy out there named David Resnick telling him he's going to create this wonderful community. That doesn't get you there. Now, if 2 years from now, that same guy, David Resnick, comes back to you and says, hey, this community I told you is great, is really good, and I got two home builders, they're each doing 30 homes a year. Now they're going to listen. Now they're going to think about really coming down. And so my job is to create a community to support my home builders and to get this thing going so that I can go to the other home builders in Colorado and say, yes, you can do 30 permits a year. You can sell 30 homes or 40 homes a year, and I've got some numbers to prove it.
Okay. So another question, just in developing water rights. I know that is a complicated item to tackle for developers. Can you just give us like, hopefully it's not opening a can of worms, but just, you know, a rundown on just how, what that looks like when you're looking at a close to $5,000 unit development, because that just seems, obviously that's a big part of it, right? Well, I see you grinning over here.
I come from Southern California and I love the movie Chinatown, because the reality is if you have enough people that want water, I don't care, they will get it.
Okay.
But it's not really that simple. So, and it's different in Colorado than it was in California. So in the northern parts of this corridor, there are some water issues because there are certain communities where you can't file or record a plat. I went to one place, I think it was Johnstown, where you can't even submit a plat if you don't have the water rights, which you usually have to buy out of a canal company or some farmer's rights. So yeah, water's a huge deal. Now, in Pueblo, it just so happens they have a ton of water. The Pueblo Board of Water Works has enough water for a long time. And they have enough water to serve all of the 4,850 units in my project and have given me a letter that says that they will. So I that, again, is another reason that I picked Pueblo. It is one of the places that does not have a water problem.
And is there, I'm curious now, is there water just coming from aquifers or surface water?
The Arkansas River.
So okay.
What happened in the old days is the guys that put in industry and that put in major railroad stops did it where water existed. And you had the Platte River, so that made Denver interesting. And you had the Arkansas River, that made Pueblo interesting. And why they shifted from Pueblo to Denver is probably a really cool story. But I don't know what that story is. But Pueblo really was on the map as the, I think Pueblo might even have been the first capital of Colorado. I can't remember. Somebody told me once, but I forget.
Okay.
But yeah, the Arkansas River is there, so they have water rights to the Arkansas River.
So that is makes a lot of sense as to why you're looking at Pueblo, or you're doing something in Pueblo again. So you had mentioned when we talked on the phone, gosh, I think a month or two ago now, there were some opportunities for individual investors down there. And I might be getting my timelines crisscrossed down here, but you had talked about a few things because going into very, you know, nitty-gritty details, and most of our listeners are, you know, individual investors with, you know, mom and pop investors where they've got a couple properties, a couple dozen properties. What type of opportunities, if any, are down there in your development for investors?
So, you know, we're at the beginning and we have good design guidelines, good HOA, a metro district. You know, we've got everything planned, you know, as the best that we can. But what we really do need are people who are building good quality properties. And I think in our, in North Vista Highlands, that's the name of this project, there are opportunities to buy one lot. That's not, it's not usual that you can go into a master planned community that's got this much planning and infrastructure behind it and buy one lot. And I can't speak for my buyers, but from what they've told me, they are going to be willing to sell one lot to someone that wants to build a rental house or a house for themselves. And that is an opportunity. That really is, because with a larger master plan community, you get parks and clubhouses and pools and, you know, the kinds of things that come with that. So I only sell to people who are buying multiple lots.
Yeah.
But I've sold the first two phases, one to a group of investors out of Colorado Springs, the other to a home builder that's a very unique home builder named Rod Stambaugh. He owns Sprout Tiny Homes, and he is going to, it's not that he's going to build tiny homes. He just owns Sprout Tiny Homes, and he has some very innovative ideas about housing of the future that includes cool things like, I don't know why I like infrared heating in the floor so much, but he does that kind of thing. And he can build a 800 square foot house that feels like a 1600 square foot house just because he knows how to design them really well.
Really?
Yeah. It's just incredible stuff that I really look at Rod as the Elon Musk of housing. And, you know, he probably thinks I'm overselling him, but I really do believe he's got the kind of innovative thinking and the drive and passion that will make stuff happen. And it could have started in LA or Dallas, but he's going to be starting this, you know, kind of here. And I think some amazing things are going to happen. So but my investor group out of Colorado Springs, they're real estate guys like your listeners. They're the kinds of people that buy and sell houses, and they want to be able to cater to other people that will want to do that. But the coolest stuff I have, and what I'm hoping somebody from this podcast will want to do, is I'm creating a little core community, a little sort of urban village, downtown area. And in that area, there are buildings, and they're sort of fourplex buildings, but it's retail, commercial on the bottom with a townhouse above. And so those are the kind of things where maybe somebody who's an attorney and wants to just have their office below their townhouse might go, or a little real estate office, or a daycare center, or a coffee shop, or somebody who's, you know, a baker or whatever. Those kind of things happen there.
So like a true live work.
You could be true live work, or, you know, I'll file, you know, Rod Stambaugh's buying the area where 8 of those will exist. But I love these buildings. They've been designed already by an architect in Pueblo, HGF Architecture, and I love the design. They're really great. I think they're going to be a hit, but they're a little bit risky because it would be a new thing for Pueblo. It'd be the kind of thing you'd see in Boulder or downtown Denver or something like that. And but I think they're going to be really nice, and they're not too big, and we can do a condominium plat so that the bottom can be sold separately from the top. But I think a lot of people would want both. And I'm just hoping somebody says, hey, one of those units, maybe the investment's $450,000 to $500,000 for the construction of one of those, you know, retail units plus the townhouse above. And maybe they stay in the townhouse above and rent the bottom or something. I don't know. But I'm really excited about those buildings. And I actually want to be involved in the construction of some of them.
And so I'm trying to visualize this. So I get the, you'll have retail commercial space on the ground floor. And then above is going to be a condo or townhouse. But you said there's going to be basically 4 units and like basically a fourplex. So it'll be, I'm just trying to visualize it. So 4 of each unit. So 4 ground units, 4 upper units with common walls in one building. Are these all freestanding buildings, or is it just depends?
So they do have common walls, but they're 4 separate legal lots.
Okay.
So even though the building's built as one building for 4 retail spaces, retail commercial spaces, 4 townhouses above those. I guess the best way to say it is there's 8 units. There's 4 commercial retail units on the bottom, 4 townhouses on the top. All the townhouses, by the way, have double garages. And each of those can be a separate unit, a separate legal unit. And the way that that happens is that between the 4 doubles, you know, the retail with the townhouse, they're separate lots. Now, even though the walls touch, you can do that in Colorado. So they're separate units, separate legal lots. And then we can file a condominium plat, which is just a vertical airspace plat, basically, between the top floor and the bottom floor. So people would be able to sell as one legal unit, either the townhouse or the retail beneath it. Separately. But what I really think is the best thing is if this community takes off as we hope it will, that retail commercial stuff's going to become pretty important. And it'll be the kind of stuff that people will want. They'll want to rent something there, and or they'll want to live work there. And, you know, the first building's the risky building.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned a few minutes ago that you want to be involved in construction of this.
Yeah.
Which, why? Because before, you know, you're doing very high level stuff where you're selling off, you know, numerous sub, you know, lots to builders. Why are you getting hands off to these buildings? What intrigues you about them?
Well, okay. My selfish motivation is to get them going.
Okay.
Because they're a big part of the project, and where I'm making my money is in the project.
So this is just one of the first dominoes to get things
this
going.
This is a domino to get things going, for sure. But that wouldn't make me get involved. What's making me get involved is I love these kind of communities. I was involved in Boise, Idaho. And Boise, Idaho is, you know, kind of like a Northwestern, you know, Pacific Northwest kind of community, even though it's inland. And there was a project that was called Bound Crossing. And in Bound Crossing, that developer, who's one of the developers I look up to, they're just really good. His father was a great developer, and the son's also a great developer. They did some nice housing units, and he created this little commercial area. And it took a while to get going, but then it's a thriving place. It's got huge character. Again, I like the community to develop a character. It's just like if you meet 20 people and 18 of them are plain vanilla, you don't really care if you go see them again. But if there's two that are just real characters, they're very interesting and they're entertaining, then you want to be with them. That's the kind of community we want out there.
So if people are interested in learning about those properties or those specific units, or just in general, do they contact you? Do they go to the website? Where can people get details on that?
If they want details on those buildings, they should contact me.
Okay.
And they can see pictures on the website.
And what's the website domain?
The website is northvistahighlands.com with no spaces or anything, just northvistahighlands.com. And it's sort of needs work. That's not the first step, you know. Actually, all the stuff that's going on right now is closing escrow February 15th. So on February 15th, if everything closes as it's supposed to, which I expect it will, then I will start the process of really beefing up the website, and I'll hire someone to make it look good and organize it a little better. But right now, you still can see I even think I have architectural renderings of those buildings.
Okay. So if they go there, whether the website's pretty or not, they can still get the details.
That's right.
And get your contact details, right?
That's right. Yes.
Great. So I'll put that link in the show notes, because I know a lot of people are driving while they're doing or while they're listening to the podcast. So, David, I want to kind of just take a step back and ask you a couple general questions, because you've, like I said, you're experienced, you've been through good times and bad times. This is my favorite question to ask people who've got experience, and it's knowing what you know now, if you could go back, you know, X number of years and go tell your, 19-year-old self when you got into real estate agent, becoming a real estate agent, what advice would you give yourself with the knowledge that you have now?
It's so cliche, but I would save my money and start a retirement account.
Just like a 401k IRA type retirement?
Any retirement account. I mean, you know, all the things that people told me to do when I was young, and I was a rebel, so I just didn't do them, like buy a whole life insurance policy. Now, a whole life insurance policy is not a great investment, especially for a guy like me who I looked at multiples of 10 times. I mean, my deals, I look for making 10 times what I put in. So boring whole life insurance policy with a lot of fees was just something I thought these guys were really literally out to get me. But if I would have bought that whole life, $1 million whole life policy when I was 20, I would have probably $1 million right now when I'm 61. And I just didn't do it.
Yeah.
And that was not good thinking. And I also, you know, retirement accounts came out when I was more like in my 20s and 30s. They became popular. I would have do that. And both my 30-year-old boys do that. So that's the main thing. Now, in terms of real estate, what would I do?
Yes.
In real estate terms, I would find real estate has so many different, it's a specialized business. It's just like medical profession. You can either be a cardiologist or an anesthesiologist or any different type of doctor because you're specializing in an industry, in a big field. Real estate's the same way. You could be in construction, you can be land, you can be an investor, you can be a broker. And what you guys seem to do is buy and sell, you know, residential properties and, mm-hmm. and some commercial properties. That's very specialized. I really know as much about that, like I said to you earlier, as I do about rocket ships. I just, even though I'm in the real estate industry, I don't really have knowledge of your area. But in the land development area, I do. And I love what I do in the industry. So I think somebody should pick what they want to do and just recognize it's 10 years before you're going to make money.
Oh, repeat that again.
It's 10 years before you're going to make money. It just is. And you got to stick with it and you got to be doing something you enjoy. And 10 years seems like a long time in year one. and a very short time in year 11.
I am not in agreement because that is almost verbatim what I say all the time. I think just in general, a lot of times people lack patience when it comes to things. And part of the problem is you go on Google and Facebook and you see all these, oh, I went from 0 units to 100 units in, you know, 92 days or whatever crazy headlines they write. But I agree with you. It's just pick what you like and then have a long-term point of view. Now, specifically, do you see any, like, in the different niches you can focus on in real estate, do you see any, like, great up-and-coming niches or areas like, hey, these are some really good areas that people could focus on, assuming they enjoy it, or is it just pick something you want to do in real estate and focus on that? I know it's a tough question, but I'm just kind of curious because you're in a totally different baseball field than I am when it comes to real estate.
I'm going to kind of really go out on left field with you on this, okay?
Okay.
So I believe that 10 years from now, you'll be able to go on Amazon or some similar website, and you'll be able to design and order a house that will be delivered and assembled on any lot in 1 week. I absolutely believe that. And that means that if you were a person that understood the technology of making all those pieces come together on a website smoothly, you'd be a gazillionaire. And if you were a person that understood how 3D printing worked and how to manufacture, you know, glass with a 3D printer, you know, right now, mostly what they do 3D print houses, which they do now, use 3D printers and make houses, they do it with this concrete slurry material. But what if people don't want that? What if they want something more like a wood or laminate or something? Anyway, I really do believe that in that field, that's where the people that are going to become, you know, multi-billionaires are going to happen. If you don't care about being a multi-billionaire, then I think, you know, just be in a good area. And the Denver metro area is a good area.
Great. David, this has been, I've learned a lot during this podcast, so thank you. And just as we wrap up, any just final thoughts or things you want to share before we hit the stop button?
I think real estate's an awesome opportunity. It's easy to look at real estate as a completely materialistic business. And so sometimes as a younger man, I used to feel a little bit guilty and like, gee, I don't really care about the world. I mean, it's not like I'm going out and creating wells for people that don't have water or building, you know, new kinds of cars, you know, use solar power to get charged and run. But it's really one of the most important things that human beings need is housing. It's right up there with food and everything else. Shelter is critical.
Yep.
And it can be a business with a moral flavor, a moral energy, a moral input to it. And I do think that anybody that wants to be successful in any kind of business, the more they can marry their morality and passion and desire to help other people to it, the more successful they'll be.
I'm nodding in agreement over here. I think that's true. And I think as the economy and trends evolve, that's just the way businesses are going, blending all that stuff together. So I think those are really great words of wisdom. So David, thank you so much. I appreciate you driving down here and taking an hour out of your schedule. So thank you.
Thank you.